we're talking about one of the dodgiest lobby operations that Brussels has seen in the last years. But this is not just another, you know, European Parliament bribery scandal. This is really about one of the world's largest, most powerful, influential tech companies.
Follow the money.
This is a podcast of the European investigative newsroom, Follow the Money. In each edition, we dive into a recent investigation exposing Europe's power brokers, from deceiving companies and influential lobbyists to corrupt politicians and financial fraudsters. I'm your host, Emma de Chassigné, recording here from Brussels. And as always, I'm joined by Follow the Money reporter Alexander Fanta in Vienna. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning. Hi.
Alex, you've done a lot of research into lobbies, especially in the tech world. What's the craziest lobby attempt that you've ever come across?
Well, that certainly must be one story back from, I think it was in 2018. I had just arrived in Brussels, and there was a war raging between the music industry and the tech industry over a new copyright law coming out of Brussels. And, you know, it was a session of the European Parliament in Strasbourg. I was sitting in a briefing room, and suddenly Wyclef Jean walked in, you know, this famous musician, singer of the Fugees. Emma, do you know the Fugees? Do you know who Wyclef Jean is at all?
Rings a bell?
So this is this iconic musician from the 1990s. Everyone who grew up in that era knows their hits. And suddenly he stands, you know, kind of in a conference room in Brussels and talks about copyright law. And I was like, what, you know, what's going on here? Why is this, you know, famous musician from the 90s washed ashore on the rocky shoals of EU legislation? That was, you know, one of the strange ways I believe, you know, people in the tech industry were trying to influence this vote, is getting all these celebrities out, you know, and it was like, suddenly there is an open letter signed by Paul McCartney, and there's like all these attempts. And that was already quite strange lobbying, you know, like enlisting people who have nothing to do with EU lawmaking into soliciting their opinions. But, you know, the tale we're talking about today is, in a sense, a lot wilder.
Today, we're taking a closer look at the most recent Brussels bribery scandal involving a Chinese tech giant Huawei. So, Alex, on March 13th, you, together with our colleague Simon van Dorpen, broke the news that Huawei is under investigation for allegedly funneling money to members of the European Parliament. Alex, what exactly is that suspicion here?
The allegation is essentially that a lobbyist working for Huawei over years kept, you know, kind of funneling money, but also gifts and, you know, expensive football tickets to MEPs in order to obtain favorable political support. So they could be signing open letters, perhaps even, you know, kind of taking public positions in favor of the company. And these allegations have really rocked Brussels. So since it became public, Huawei has been excluded from the European Parliament, is banned from lobbying the Commission. It has been thrown out of important trade associations, or its membership has been suspended. We're talking about one of the, I'd say, dodgiest lobby operations that Brussels has seen in the last years. But this is not just another, you know, European Parliament bribery scandal like the ones we've seen in recent years. This is really about one of the world's largest, most powerful, influential tech companies. And it's also a very, very important Chinese tech company. So there's all the geopolitical baggage that comes with that.
And of course, these corruption scandals, they always happen for a reason. I mean, there's big risks, there's high stakes. But of course, people do this because they want to achieve something with it. And the central figure in your story is a lobbyist that worked for Huawei, who's called Valerio Oh. And I think in the Huawei case, what Valerio Oh's task was essentially was to create a more positive image of Huawei within the European Parliament, correct?
I think the first objective of Huawei was to muddy the waters. So I think there was a point in early 2020 when they were under immense pressure, to exclude Huawei from the phone networks. And they didn't have a lot of public support then. So the first objective was to at least have a couple of voices in the public domain who were saying something completely different, who were saying, well, you know, if you exclude Huawei, it's going to be so much more expensive to build these cell phone networks. It's going to raise consumer prices. So they needed somebody to say this publicly. And that is what, you know, some of these actions that Valeria allegedly orchestrated were supposed to do. I think just like kind of paint a different picture, put in different voices in the public discourse. So it was very subtle in a sense.
One key question that remained unanswered after your first story is the question, did Huawei's leadership condone or perhaps even enable this Valerio O? To find out the answer to that question, you and Simon teamed up once again to dig deeper into this unusual figure at the heart of it all. Welcome, Simon.
Hi, thanks for the invite.
A little throwback, this whole story was a major scoop by Follow the Money and its Belgian partners Le Soir and Knak last March. Can you take us back to that day, March 13th? The police raided offices of Huawei. What did that day look like for you?
It was a day that we kind of expected. We received a tip quite a while ago that this might happen one day. But the day itself, yes, of course, was full of adrenaline. We heard indeed that the police raids were taking place. 100 police officers or around 100 were involved with raids in several locations in and around Brussels, but also in Portugal and in France. People were arrested that day. We heard that 15 former and current members of the European Parliament were sort of on the radar of this investigation. Police arrested some people that day, also the days after, and 8 people were charged with active corruption, money laundering, and participation in a criminal organization, including at least 2 Chinese managers at the EU office and Valerio O, this lobbyist who is suspected to be at the heart of the corruption scandal as well.
And since that day, the police has, of course, continued its investigation, but so has Follow the Money. And what's the reason that you guys wanted to continue digging into this company and digging into this figure?
I mean, as Alex eloquently laid out, this is a big case because of the involvement of Huawei, which is one of China's most significant companies. And this is not the first time this happens in the European Parliament, this kind of corruption scandal. We've had a few over the past years, and most notably was Qatargate, another big corruption scandal. And so, yes, this comes on top of that. And we wanted to understand better, okay, how do these things work in practice? So we try to gather as much information as possible to have some, you know, facts from the ground and really try to demystify in a way also this scandal and see, you know, what really happened there.
And what you just said, you wanted to understand how these things work in practice. And what did you find out about that?
So this Valerio O, he used to work at the European Parliament. He was an assistant to 2 Italian members of the European Parliament. He's himself Italian origin, but born and raised in Belgium. He moved to Huawei after a decade, more or less, at the European Parliament. He joined the company, which at that time was really ramping up its lobbying efforts because it was being accused by the US of spying on European citizens. They really needed to rebuff that allegation. And so he was hired as part of that effort. And he had obviously his people skills. He was sort of a smooth operator, let's say. He knew how to open doors at the European Parliament. He had a lot of contacts. He was quite a character at the office.
To say the least.
To say the least. I mean, his colleagues repeatedly complained about his behavior. We had like, you know, strong indications of things like drug use, including at the office. There were complaints about that to management, falsifying documents. He also confessed some of that to the police.
Falsifying documents? What kind of documents was he falsifying?
Those were meetings that he claimed to have had with MEPs. He had a little booklet, 2 people told us, with tickets of a restaurant, like blank tickets, where you could, for instance, fill out, okay, 2 meals cost so much. And the final bill was 150 euros. And then he would file that expense notes to his management and say, I had a lunch with this important MEP and we discussed this and that. And And that he would not only get those expenses reimbursed or those supposed expenses, but he would also increase his bonus because Huawei is very much focused on getting as much meetings as possible.
So in the end, the whole scandal basically came about because there's one guy who was very much focused on his incentives, on his bonus, and he was paid based on how many meetings he had, no matter how much the meetings made sense or not. And then he'd go out and he'd just kind of, you know, allegedly bribe people to have these meetings with him. So that's the whole strange story, isn't it, Simon?
Indeed, yes. Well, I think in a way there's the fake meetings and there's the real meetings because he was also successful. Several people said he did manage to get some meetings. He did manage to get people to events, but I think the allegations of bribery kick in where he did manage to get people to events. Like, how did he manage to get them to events, but also, for instance, to football games or to sign letters? That is where there are some indications of bribery. So all these things we started to understand better. And then we had to decide when we started to think about writing a story about which of these elements were actually relevant for the corruption scandal, which were less relevant. So that's how we approached this.
How did you make those decisions? What do you see as relevant for a story and as a journalist?
I mean, look, we didn't want to make it exactly a profile of Valerio O, right? So we haven't also included in the story all kind of information that would have completed that picture. I think also for legal reasons, but also in the interest of having a story that was really targeted towards, okay, what's the relevance of this character in this corruption investigation? We kind of stuck to all the behavior, let's say, at the office, which could have raised issues with the management, which should have alerted the management or could have been reasons to let him go.
A lot of this information that you've discovered in the story is information that you gathered from former employees. What made them willing to talk?
That's a question for the employees, I guess. But some of them told us, like, look, the reason why we speak is because there is this huge scandal which is reflecting on all of our reputation.
And I can imagine it's definitely not without risk for them to speak to journalists. And how does this work? Like, is it like in the movies? Do you meet them in secret places, in like parking garage? How should I imagine this situation?
Look, I mean, we're limited in what we can say about our interactions with sources, especially to protect them. The first meeting, I think we can disclose, happened already back in October last year with our colleague Lisanne van Vught, who has also helped out on this story. It was not yet clear that there was a police investigation. We knew, but we had to keep this completely secret, also including to the people we were speaking to.
After speaking to all these people, what's the picture of this Valerio O that you got?
I think the impression that I got from talking to all these people who knew him is that Valerio O is like a very kind of, on the face of it, charming, charismatic, but also knows no boundaries, is willing to say anything, do anything to get what he wants. Maybe a funny character if you know him superficially, but very hard to be around for a longer time.
And so, yeah, he was a very extrovert person, but most things we heard were negative. And one thing that kept coming back was the lying. You could never know if what he was saying was true or false. That was obviously a problem for the trust that his colleagues could have in his work, for the interaction between them, but also at a more personal level. I think it got some people really, you know, to hate the character. There was, I think our story opens with a famous anecdote. Alex, you know this better. He called a European commissioner at some point, and that caused a major incident. What happened there?
I mean, so you have to imagine this is the hate of pressure on Huawei at that point. The European Commission just basically told member states, please exclude Huawei from your networks. And so the lobbyists in Brussels are frantic. They're trying to get this high profile meeting between the company rotating chairman, Ken Hu, and this kind of crucial commissioner, Thierry Breton, the French commissioner in charge of regulating telecoms. And then after weeks and weeks of pressure and lobbying, they secure a video meeting at the height of the pandemic in December 2020. And then that meeting happens and, you know, can who makes all the talking points, tells, you know, kind of Breton how he wants to keep access to the European market. But right after the meeting, something really strange happens. This Valeria O takes out his phone and he calls Breton on his private number and, you know, screams down the phone, says, you know, like kind of yells at him. Just a very bizarre incident, you know, and something that is absolutely not done. So if you're a lobbyist, you're not supposed to call a commissioner on his personal cell phone. It's just a breach of etiquette. It's a breach of protocol. And Breton, who's like this kind of very imperious French guy, he really hated it. So the very next thing that happens, the commission lets Huawei know that that was a total no-go. The company immediately sends a very mealy-mouthed apology email to Breton's cabinet, but it doesn't help. A couple of weeks later, there is a meeting and Breton's cabinet tells Huawei that their lobbyists are banned from speaking directly with any kind of officials within Breton's department, DG Connect. They're just cut out from normal kind of lobbying channels. So this is really quite stern reprimand. And that means that a lot of the things the company worked for weeks and weeks were basically voided by Valerio's absolutely bizarre mistake.
Yeah, bizarre, exactly. Because surely he also realized that that's a no-go, right?
We can't look inside. We can't look inside Valerio. We don't quite know why he did what he did. But still, the fact remains, he made a terrible mistake. The company still kept him on. And we don't, Huawei never credibly answered why they kept him on despite this mistake and despite many other kind of failings as an employee. But there were some ethical concerns around his conduct, but still the company kept him on and, you know, kind of left him in a crucial position talking to these members of parliament all the time, making him the public face of the company in the European Parliament.
But what I find it really interesting is that from what you're telling me, it becomes very clear that, okay, he's a person that was able to get what he wanted. But at the same time, management seemed to know that there was also something really wrong going on there. So was he doing what he wanted? Was he doing what Huawei wanted? Was it Huawei's management that sort of pushed him to cross these boundaries? Did he influence management to be okay with that? What's sort of your impression in that sense?
I think this will be a crucial question also in court if it gets there, because I mean, to be clear, we're still at the investigation stage. Prosecutors haven't moved on to indictment yet, and that may still take a while. But when this case gets to court, one could argue that in the end, many of these corruption schemes were approved by the management. And that is what several people also of these former employees told us. Like, look, any amount that needed to be approved, and some of these corruption allegations include like cash amounts that have been wired to different companies, they needed to be approved by the management. This sort of raises the question, like, what is the respective responsibility of each here? Because of course, like, it's up to the management to fire this person. If you have sort of a rogue employee, okay, let him go. But especially if somebody, you know, if it would have been his initiative to start these, and some of his former colleagues believe that, you know, he was initiating or giving these ideas, you know, based on his previous experiences in the European Parliament, thinking he would often say this is the way it happens in Brussels. You know, if people would criticize, like, you know, should we, you know, give all these gifts to Parliament members, or shouldn't we be more careful with like lobbying rules? He would say, come on, this is how it rolls. Otherwise, you're never going to get your access.
Is that true? Is that how it simply works in Brussels?
I mean, it seems from some of these cases now, Qatargate and Huaweigate, it seems that there are networks of MEPs who are engaged in such, you know, bribery activities. Now, how big that group is, that's a hard question. I mean, these are things that don't just happen out in the open, or that are possible to investigate with a quick check on the internet. So it really takes police and wiretapping and checking bank accounts to find this out. But the fact that, like, on such short notice, we have two of these like big corruption scandals is alarming.
If we imagine for a moment that the police raids hadn't happened, no one had been arrested, and Valerio O was still with Huawei, can we say he was successful at his job?
I think to a certain extent he was, especially when you look at how Huawei incentivized people. So he got a lot of meetings. So in that sense, he was successful for Huawei. Okay, some of those meetings probably didn't take place, but some others did, and he got some people to events. He got some photos, where the Huawei EU manager is on a picture with an MEP or with a European Commission official. Valerio was using these rope techniques, like bribing people, or at least like all kind of gifts and opening doors like this, but with sometimes little effect. Some of the other colleagues had the impression that there was a good case that could be made through technical engagement with EU officials, with European Commission, European Parliament, and Valerio seemed to turn to like this limited group of MEPs, some of which were influential, but others were not at all. And then is the question indeed, like, okay, there is, as Alex said, there is some PR value to getting someone to sign a letter to that Huawei can say, look, you know, there's some people on our side here, and look at our argument. If you see like a letter from 8 members of the European Parliament saying this, that gives some credibility to the claim. But as I just said, when it really comes to the content and to the crucial documents where, you know, high level EU officials are drafting, you know, like the 5G toolbox, for instance, that was a big defeat actually for Huawei. So yes, I think there is some effectiveness to such methods from a PR perspective. But when it comes to really changing European decision making, I think it was very limited.
We have to also remember the basic irony of this story is that Simon just mentioned the 5G toolbox. This is kind of the Commission telling the member states to exclude Huawei in early 2020. But the thing is, the European Union has very, very limited power over, telling member states whom to exclude or not exclude for security persons from the networks. So essentially, this was always a decision taken in the capitals of the member states, never in Brussels. Any lobbying activity in Brussels would only very indirectly influence what the member states were actually doing. So lobbying in Brussels was always more about the vibes than about the actual impact on legislation.
It's so clear, or at least it seems so clear to me, that there's such a huge risk for Huawei in terms of what they were doing here with, well, in the end, limited effect. How is it possible that they were even able to do this? And were there no rules in place that would have prevented them from doing it?
I think an element of that is the big distance between Shenzhen and Brussels. I think the management of Huawei was not sufficiently aware of the local context. And I mean, okay, some of these facts happened before the Qatargate scandal, we should add. But especially after, I mean, it was very clear that, like, if you ever get caught with one of these things, it's gonna be destroying your reputation.
And you're mentioning some of these facts happened before the Qatargate, some happened after. What changed?
Qatargate was a wake-up call for many people that this kind of stuff actually happens in Brussels. And you saw a huge wave of outrage from members of the European Parliament, from different officials in the media. There was a big debate about, like, okay, how is this possible in Brussels? What can we do to change the rules? So a lot of debate about this. And I think for members of the European Parliament who may have been engaged in corrupt activities, this was especially a sign that, like, you might actually get caught doing this. So you have to be very careful. This police and intelligence are actually checking on our phone conversations. And a lot of the potential corrupt activity that happened before may have been toned down significantly after these revelations.
So are you essentially saying it's because people got, MEPs got more scared, or have the rules also been changed?
I think it's more that people got scared. The rules have been changed a bit left and right, but nothing really essential.
I think there's a scale of activity where, you know, something might be problematic or bordering on corruption, but might not be outright corrupt. So I think people's perception in Brussels around what is an absolute no-go has changed a bit. You know, it has become a bit more focused that, for instance, accepting an expensive gift is just simply unacceptable, something that people might not have been aware about to the full extent.
You seem to be describing it as if it's a matter of perception, what is acceptable or not, but surely there are very clear rules about what is acceptable or not, right? I can imagine it's a set amount or something.
I think it's quite clear that when you accept, you know, let's say €1,000 to bring an amendment in the European Parliament, that is an outright act of corruption. So there's there's different ways MEPs can handle it when they get an expensive gift. But like the best practice is maybe something that Manfred Weber, the powerful leader of the European People's Party group, did. So I think about more than 10 years ago, Huawei gave him a smartphone as a gift. And what he did is he went to the European Parliament Secretariat, handed it in and said, this gift is too expensive for me to accept. So it became kind of came into the possession of the Parliament itself, and it was registered on a list of gifts. So that is what some of the MEPs could have done. What they ended up doing, though, is that's the allegation, just pocketing a very expensive gift. You know, does that already clear the threshold of corruption? That's a question for the prosecutors and the judge to answer. But it's still, you know, kind of if that is indeed what happened. But the tricky bit for prosecutors is sometimes to show that there is a clear tit for tat. So, for instance, you accept a gift that is slightly too expensive, would have to be declared under the European Parliament's rules, but wouldn't not necessarily contravene in accepting it. But then at what point can it be clearly be shown that you have done something in the interest of the company in exchange for that gift, you know? So that's the tricky bit in proving. It's also, I think I just wanted to make another note on in terms of, you know, kind of the institutional response to the scandal. I think what has been very surprising on the day that the raids went down, the former director of Transparency International EU, intervened on social media and said, well, you know, we received a very specific whistleblower tip, echoing some of the very allegations now being investigated already in 2022. And that tip was then forwarded by Transparency National to Olaf, the European Anti-Corruption Office. But what it appears is that Olaf had received quite specific information, but sat on it, did nothing with it. And then eventually, 3 months later, told TI that they wouldn't take any action about Huawei. So perhaps the scandal could have become public and become investigated by authorities way earlier had Olaf decided to, kind of do something with the information received from the whistleblower or pass it on to other authorities. And I think there is still, so the head of Olaf, the director came out in an interview and said, the allegations just weren't specific enough. But I think Olaf still has a bit of explaining to do in terms of why they didn't think these allegations specific enough to do anything.
And so instead it was left to investigative journalists like yourselves that did think there was enough reason to further dig into it.
The Belgian prosecutors, of course, who have taken it up.
All right. I think that's where we'll leave it for today. Thank you so much for joining us, Simon. You can find the link to both stories written by Simon and Alexander in the description. And Alex and I will be back soon for another episode.
You've listened to the podcast of Follow the Money. Our watchdog journalism is funded by our members. Subscribe and support European investigative journalism.